12 years ago, in which displacement or IDP's assistance was pretty much a matter of three phases: the prevention, the humanitarian assistance, and the socioeconomic stabilization phases. With that in mind, we had to bring on board more issues that were that had come to the attention either of the government or of the judiciary in Colombia. So we developed a policy which with much more elements. These elements are three main components, four cross-cutting issues, and two scenarios of implementation. I'm pretty much going to talk about the three main components and briefly only mention the cross-cutting elements and the scenarios of implementation of the policy. The three main components which are there are, they're in Spanish, but I'm translating as I go along, are, again, prevention. Second, what we call comprehensive assistance. And third, which is the new one that has created the most discussion in the last, let's say, 24 months, which is truth, justice, and reparation. We change the concept of the phases of humanitarian assistance and socioeconomic stabilization because we have understood, and the actual Constitutional Court also had demanded, that in a country like Colombia, after the emergency phase, there was not much waiting for IDPs, or the things that were waited for them could last long enough to produce differences in their lives, that you needed something else, and that actually assistance in terms of their basic needs has to go parallel to the effort of creating the capacities within the families to create their own income and their own means to move along with their lives. So that's why we changed to from a phases kind of approach to like a comprehensive assistance, in which you provide some pretty much assistance type of elements at the same time that you try to develop capacities in the families with giving them assets or giving them training or giving them something else that in some cases even it may take a whole life to actually produce a difference in the families. In terms of prevention and protection, we have made some changes, some tactical changes in the policy. We have addressed some issues that has to do with the military operations that eventually could produce displacements. We have introduced in the regulations of the military some issues that can help those operations to prevent or to avoid producing displacement. We also have addressed a problem with the protection of the leaders of the IDPs organizations. So the screening process of the level of risk of those leaders can be more accurate. And we're testing this. Most of the things that we have changed or addressed are too soon to be evaluated at this point. So we hope with some of these changes we will be able to produce better results. And as I'm going to tell you my third point, we have a very good tool today to actually monitor the impact and effectiveness of our policies and strategies. Comprehensive attention, which is the second one, is includes five main elements. One of these is the humanitarian assistance element. The other one, which is their parallel or counter phase or whatever element, which is the basic comprehensive assistance. Basic comprehensive assistance means health, education, food, and what we call family reunification. Then we go to the three main topics of assistance, the ones that produce the more complicated issues, which need more budget and will need a longer term to actually produce a difference in the families, which are housing, land access, and income generation. While a family is able to have their own houses, or have access to their own land or to land and produce their own income, we will need to provide either humanitarian assistance or basic comprehensive assistance. The difference between one and another is we really want to limit humanitarian assistance to the very initial phase of displacement, but we won't take a family out of humanitarian assistance until we're not secure that they have been included in more long-term assistance programs in what we call now our national protection system or our national social protection system. So that's pretty much the idea behind that that component. The third component is truth, justice, and reparation. It is still under a lot of discussion. I just want to share with you some of the strategies that are behind this huge and complicated component. In terms of truth, we're moving on, especially with the National Reparation and Reconciliation Commission, in trying to do what is called historic truth, and try to do more cases of historic truth, mostly with the hand of some events that not only produce displacement, but also produce some other kind of crimes. And we hope to move as quickly as possible with this, because it really creates a sense of peace within families when you provide more truth of what happened to them. And they get more ready to move on with their lives when these kind of things happen. In terms of justice, most of our bets are on the creation of a special unit inside the Fiscalía. This is our district attorney, our attorney general office, and unit that specializes on displacement. This unit was officialized 2 months ago, but its creation has been discussed and implemented for the last 18 months or so. It is supposed to start with something close to 20 attorneys and more than 100 what we call judicial police to help start solving some of the crimes that are behind the problem of displacement. We want to start, we have suggested, the Fiscalía, which is actually on their own turf to decide that. We have suggested them to start with the problem of collective displacement. We have something close to 1,200 collective displacements registered in our registration system that counts for probably something close to 80,000 families, and it will be a good start with those, let's say, 1,200 collective displacement that we need to go after the criminals that produce those displacements. So that's our recommendation to the attorney's office, to the Fiscalía, and we hope we can make rapid progress on the judicialization, on the prosecution of these criminals. On reparation, we have ideas for each of what internationally, each of the internationally recognized elements of reparation to create a more comprehensive policy. But underneath all those strategies, there is a single idea of what our reparation for IDPs should be. And that single idea is our reparation should not be a monetary process, a monetary transfer process. Cash reparations, it is a good business for lawyers. It's not a good business for vulnerable people. We have a money transfer-based reparation system for the other victims, and what we have discovered in these 18 months of implementation of that other reparation system is what I just said. Lawyers are charging 30% to the victims to do a process that in itself is for free. They tend to frame innocent people alleging that they can produce better results if they're mandated by them to do the process in their names, which is not true, which doesn't produce any better results for them. But people end up giving them their 30% of whatever the compensation is, which today, since it says it is a symbolic compensation that comes from a transitional justice kind of system, is only something close to $10,000. So out of the 30% is again, it's not a lot of money for the IDP. Several of them would be a good money for the lawyer, but that's not the idea of this system. So that's one of the reasons why we don't want with IDPs to do a reparation system that depends on money transfer and that give opportunity to lawyers to actually frame the IDPs. International Crime Court, La Corte Penal Internacional, is following this kind of ideas also for developing countries, because it's kind of the same way everywhere else. So that's one of the things that we believe, and we have spoken with this in private with the Constitutional Court. How long do I have left? 8 minutes left. We have spoken with the Constitutional Court about this. I think they agree with us. Not all the judicial system or the judicial branch is agreed with this idea, but we believe we're going to make a good move with the Constitutional Court, but it's on their own turf again to decide what it is good or not in terms of reparation to do one that doesn't imply the transfer of cash to the victims, or at least it is not based basically on the transfer of cash, that the transfer of cash should be a minimal part of the reparation. We're trying to move very hard with a piece of legislation that will enable the judges to provide quick answers on the claims on land disputes. I think that's the most important thing that we can achieve in terms of reparation. When we check the registration system, there are something close to 300,000 disputes over land that people say they have. We have cleaned that number a little bit to believe that probably we need to solve something in the neighborhood of 200,000 claims on land because of displacement. That will need more than a very expedite, or along with a more expedite system of claims, we will need, let's say, a system of companionship, of comprehensive and interdisciplinary assistance to the claimants, so we can solve the problem that each piece of land have. We can move quickly with this issue. We're thinking in funding that particular issue, the companionship with these interdisciplinary groups, which is composed basically by lawyers and other and technicals, land technical people that can help solve the problem. We have had pilot projects on that give us the idea that we will be pretty much successful. We're thinking on putting something close to 120 interdisciplinary groups that will have a rate of solving land tenure issues something close to 4,000 a month, and that will allow us in a year to solve something close to 40,000 to 50,000 claims. And if this is successful, we will mean that all these claims will be over around 5 to 6 years. Will be a good news. And right now, the money is there, but I will go back to that in the last part. We're also trying to do some compensation in terms of cash, but it will be given along with some other program. Basically, with programs on housing and land access, meaning that you don't get the money just in cash in front of you, but you will get as part of a higher offer, a wider effort for you to get housing and land. Specifically, we're talking that if the normal program of housing subsidies is, let's say, 20 for any regular Colombia, it will be 30 for an IDP. So the 10 difference is the compensation that the IDP gets for being a victim of war. So that's the kind of system we're moving on with right now. I'm going to stop that with truth and reparation because I know I have very limited time. We're paying attention to the four cross-cutting issues, which are shaded areas in the diagram up there. One is what we call differential focus, which is pretty much affirmative action for some special protected groups, basically women, children, the elderly, the minorities. So every component of the policy has to create differential issues, differential instruments or tools to address the problems of those specific groups. We have not done a very good job on doing that because there's not very much experience all over the world in doing this. So any experience that you know you have, it will be helpful to the Colombia government for this. Where have we done very recently good steps for this? In humanitarian assistance, for instance, we are really moving along a very different system that pretty much promotes different tools and instruments for this kind of special protected groups. We also have to look at institutional capacity and information systems. Every attention, every assistance that you provide to an IDP has to be implemented with better institutional capacity, but which is more important, with better systems of information or information systems. I'm going to stop that. We need, and this is becoming a huge complex issue, but very interesting alone, every decision that you make in terms of policy for IDPs has to be, let's say, consulted with the organizations of the IDPs. We've done that over the last 18 months. It is a process that creates a lot of stress because consulting can have very many different meanings. IDPs would love, of course, to say that they have the last word on their policy, but that will be actually conflict of interest that the IDPs decide over their own policy or the policies that benefit them. But we do have to, we have a protocol of participation, and we have to follow that protocol of participation every time we take a decision. And that protocol of participation is actually very detailed and complex when it comes with minorities, Afro-Colombians, and indigenous population. Finally, and I think this is one of the most important cross-cutting issues, is the territorial articulation, or what is called the I don't know if that's the word, the concurrence between local governments and the national governments in terms of who has which responsibility in terms of assistance. Two last ideas, because I believe my time is running up. Every single piece of this very huge policy has been valued, has been costed. I don't know if that's the right expression. We know how much that it cost. The overall strategy, as this is designed, will cost over the next 10 years. There are some costs that's for once, but there are costs that have to be every year. So for the next 10 years, will cost $22 billion, and we're ready to make that investment. Right now, today, we are investing something close to 13 billion. So we need something, 14 billion. We need something close to $8 additional billion. And we're ready to make that move. We have actually consulted with the new government if they're also ready to make that move, and they say they are. So I think we're in a good shape to change mostly things that have been unattended up to today, which is land access, the restitution of land process, and income generation. Those are three areas in which we haven't had enough money there, and they will have money beginning 2011. Finally, and is the thing that I work the most on, all this system is today under a very sophisticated and developed monitoring system. Internally, we call that Juntos, and some other things besides Juntos. We are able today to track each single family that is displaced. We create a baseline of their human achievement, or the right enjoyment. We will accompany that family until it successfully enjoy every single of the 45 rights that the Constitutional Court has pinpointed that are the most important for IDPs. Okay.
Thank you very much. Well, the International Committee of the Red Cross is present in Colombia since 1969. Our main mandate is to protect and assist the victims of armed conflict, and internal displacement is the major part of that. In Colombia, about 80% of the assistance we're giving out is going to IDPs. Compared to Action Social, our mandate is a bit different. The ICC concentrates on the emergency phase, so we have a partial overview. We have a concentration on the first 3 months of displacement, which gives us a little bit of a different perspective than from what Armando was telling us now. We try to substitute the state only when absolutely needed. We prefer to support and complement the state. And in Colombia, given that we are there and we have to assist about 40,000 people a year in individual assistance, means that there is a need for a certain substitution still on the way. In our offices, in our operations, the main causes of displacement in 2009 were combat, death threats, psychological treatment, and forced recruitment. And I would also like to mention that the eradication of illicit crops, I talk here about the coca eradication programs, have led to a big number of people who had to leave their fields and lands. And that is especially because eradication of illicit crops is accompanied by armed groups, or is combating armed groups, and police are accompanying the eradication process, which causes combat during the process of eradication, which causes a lot of displacement, which is actually not always recognized by the state. The ICC assists about 40,000 people in individual assistance. These are individual persons who come to our offices, who seek assistance. They had to leave their homes. They travel for certain weeks until they are there. We have a very close collaboration with the Colombian Red Cross in 5 out of 14 towns. They implement together with us those programs. The other part is happening in the rural areas, in the fields. We talk about massive displacement. Massive displacement is a group of more than 10 people, or 10 families, sorry. And we talk about villages who have to leave their land because of the events I said before, mostly combat. The ICC had to intervene in 25 cases, assisting 11,000 people in 2009. This particular part of the operation, we have an agreement with Action Social and the government which specifies each other's role. The ICC would like in all cases that the neutrality of our operation is respected. So we will only assist cases the others cannot assist. We would have a deal with Action Social on agreeing who is taking on which case. Very often those cases are in very remote areas. That's where the combats happen. That's where access is very difficult and very logistical. Logistically speaking, you have a big trouble getting there and assisting those people. For us, as ICC, we think we have the most added value exactly in this field of work, where others can't work and where it's quite difficult to get there. Now, just a figure over the last 13 or 14 years, since 1997, the ICC has assisted more than 1.2 million IDPs in Colombia. You see the green bars, this is the individual assistance, that's what I talked about before, the people coming to our offices. The blue bars, these are the massive displacements which happen in the field, in the rural areas. And I would also mention here the tendency, when you see, as of 2008, the figures start to decrease, and in 2010 we observe exactly the same tendency. So from our point of view, we had to assist less people with assistance under the frame of IDPs in the last 3 years. There are certain reasons which I think not all are conflict related. First reason is the ICC has closed down 4 offices in the north, so less geographical coverage in areas where we think combat and conflict is no longer so intense. So obviously our figures go down, not because there's less displaced people, because we have closed offices. But there is also a change to be observed in the patterns in the behavior of IDPs. In many areas, people don't leave their area fields and houses so quickly anymore. It was previously the case that displacement was taking place in a rather preventive way. Today we can say people try to stick it out, they try to stay as long as they can, and they only leave it's no longer otherwise possible. That has led also to a decrease in IDP figures, I think, in the country. And obviously the conflict dynamics, I think we can say that the conflict today in Colombia has concentrated on certain areas. It no longer covers the same areas geographically as it did 3-4 years before. But that has clearly led to the fact that less people are today displaced than, I would say, 10 years ago. Whereas I'm talking, or I was talking before, about 40, 50, 60,000. These are only the 3 months recent displaced people the ICC is taking into account. That has nothing to do with the global figure. The NGOs, CODES, estimates that there's 4.9 million people displaced in the country, and Acción Social recognizes 3.3 million. That means you have, we're talking here about huge amounts of people who are officially displaced, who are in the situation legally in the right of having state support as being displaced. And as I said before, if that figure is the second highest in the world after Sudan, probably. State response to the IDPs, taking on what Armando said before, indeed, we can observe a quite positive internal reorganization in Acción Social. They managed to be much more efficient in validating the status of IDPs, and the delivery of aid was clearly improved thanks to cash disbursements in the emergency phase only. I'm talking here. On the other hand, unfortunately, those improvements could not yield in better results during 2010 because simply Acción Social was running out of budget in June. They just received, I heard yesterday, a little ad of budget, but for the second semester of 2010, there's definitely not much money available to serve the IDPs. And as a consequence, the newly displaced people have to wait for several months, I guess, until the next budget is going to drop in. Everybody talks about a very good legislation. 387 was mentioned before, the law 387 from 2008. It's a fact, yes, Colombia has very good laws on IDPs, and the Constitutional Court has clearly stepped forward and has defended the IDPs in a very constructive way. I would mention two things which the Constitutional Court has done in 2008. First, the time limit was taken away. That means today you can declare your displacement also if it happened 10 or 20 years ago. That means there's no time limit anymore on the event when it actually happened. And the second, the state, according to the Constitutional Court, the state has to give emergency help to the victims until they're sustainable. And that can take an infinite number of years. So for us, although that it's very much praised, the law 387 and the Constitutional Court, what they did, it has a consequence for the IDPs, which is that the system is overloaded. The demands which those two new rules created to Acción Social are so much that simply the system cannot have the capacity to absorb all that. If you imagine, the demand has increased tremendously with all those people who newly go into the system, but were displaced 10 or 20 years ago. And additionally, all those people who receive maybe 12 months of assistance, they can now prolong their assistance for many years. So those two effects are having an impact on the recent displaced nowadays, which means that the recent displaced cannot get help because the budget to 80% is going to channels which is prolongation of aid, emergency aid to people who were displaced many years before. We as ICRC, we see a challenge in there that the funds would be probably rechanneled a bit more to the recent displaced people, and that for those people who are displaced in the long term, one would make available long-term programs, as Armando has specified. So in 2010, in times of limited resources, we would propose that we would rather give priority to the emergency assistance, to the recently displaced people. And we hope that the government will make available for 2011 a budget which is adequate to the needs. Armando mentioned the new government is willing to go for that, but the amounts are huge when we hear about those billions. I have my doubts if the country can bear such a load of continuous payments for many years. In times of bad economy or difficult economy, that's not going to be easy. And what I said before, towards the law, the legislation, there's a need to regulate better those laws. It cannot be that somebody has the right to receive assistance ad infinitum. No, we have to get limits there set. So the regulation of those laws needs to be fine-tuned and, I think, better done. Action Sociale is in process of doing that. They've in May presented a new proposal that, for example, the aid, the emergency aid assistance is limited to 12 months at first, which I think that makes sense. So I think in order to help the state to discharge the system a little bit, to make it more bearable, more reasonable, the regulation has to be made in a more perfect way. Challenges I see in the IDP public policy, it's a long-term challenge. 3.3 million are officially accepted as IDPs. They have rights, and they have, after all, they have a big need of sustainable solutions. We talk about return, relocations, or problems in for IDPs who are in urban settlements. What happens is that there's a debate ongoing if how many want to go back, actually. That might be very possible that not all want to go back, but I don't think that that is the end of the discussion. If they don't want to go back, maybe they have to be relocated. If those who don't want to be relocated want to stay where they are, we have to find solutions for them in the actual situation where they are. And very often, they live in the worst areas of the big towns, where we have all the typical problems of urban character, urban violence, no income generation, and limited state services. For 2010, that is the motto that the ICC has put up, which we would like to work for it a bit more. We would like to make the conflict a bit more visible. We have the impression that there's a tendency that one doesn't talk anymore about the conflict in Colombia. When you look at the presidential elections recently, when you look at the debates, that was no longer a subject. When you look about what is the dialogue in the diplomatic community, then you talk about the TLC, which means the free trade agreement. You talk about investments. You talk about other things. So slowly, the subject of IDPs and the conflict is disappearing, which is a little bit preoccupying us. I agree that the trend is very positive in Colombia, so the number of people probably which are displaced every year is decreasing. But even one more displaced, if you add that to the accumulated number which already exists, makes the accumulated number bigger. So even if the trend from year to year is going down, the number of total displaced is increasing. And I think the ICC would like to contribute this year that the conflict is remaining a priority in the new government and in the new legislations, and that international community as well is continue to contribute in donor funding and in the way that the IDPs can be served also at long term in that country. Thank you.
Good afternoon. First, I want to thank Brookings for inviting me to speak at this event, and thank you all for coming on such a hot day when the temptation is clearly other than doing something other than going out into the streets and coming to an event, even in an air-conditioned room. I don't have a PowerPoint, and I've learned a long time ago that if you're the third speaker and you're supposed to comment, it's best not to have one so that you're not locked into what you intended to say only to hear other people repeat the same points or repeat or to say things that you were going to say in a different way. But I think this would be pretty clear and pretty short. I want to start off by noting that I was reading recently about a system created in Colombia in 2007 to track demobilization and reintegration of former combatants. And that system involves it is run by the Colombia High Commissioner for Reintegration, and the hope is to reintegrate, to ensure the reintegration into civilian life of the 53,000 former combatants. And it includes programs of health, education, psychosocial support, job training, income generation opportunities, and so on. But these are for the registered former combatants. Now, registered IDPs number quite a few more, as we've heard so far. And the numbers range from 3 million. Well, the registered IDPs are in the neighborhood of 3 million. So that's a bit more of a challenge, especially in these difficult budget times, as we have just heard. And as we've just heard, the mandate for attention to IDPs was first the Law 387 mandates attention to IDPs, and the Constitutional Court over the years has held the state to account on the measures in that law. Acción Social is by far the main entity that attends to the needs of IDPs. Acción Social, to this date in a case, has been overwhelmingly oriented toward what Armando Escobar called humanitarian assistance. And there are integration elements in this humanitarian assistance, but I think it's fair to say that to date, in any case, the overwhelming emphasis has been on relief. Now, the integrated attention, I think, is very good news. This is a declared intention of Acción Social to look beyond the relief and to try to work towards something more approaching integration. But still, I think one of the problems is that Acción Social is in there to a large extent alone, and the other institutions of the Colombian government have much less responsibility and are leaving a great deal of the work to be done only to Acción Social. I want to affirm that my job is, of course, to say that, oh, everything that the Colombian government says is not quite the way they say it. And I don't want it to be that kind of critical, just plain criticism coming. I don't want to take that role. So I want to affirm in the beginning that despite fragilities, uneven practice, the humanitarian attention to IDPs has been steadily improving over the years. And it's also true that the government has many people who are committed, competent, and determined to make the attention better. Whether the resources will be, I hope the resources for this are forthcoming, because if resources are forthcoming, and if the tendencies, the lines just elaborated for us, continue, then the situation will be, then the attention will continue to be improved. At least that's the hope. But so let me go now to the qualifiers. That's why I was invited here. Overwhelmingly, as I said, the emphasis is on relief. And this is, when you think about it, this is a serious problem. If displacement is lasting 5 years, 10 years, and people are still getting relief, then it's unlikely they're going to be able to find a stable economic place in Colombian society. Government programs on the long term are dismal. And as Armando Escobar has just said, the income generation, which is absolutely key to integration, has not done very well. I'm not faulting Acción Social for doing it badly, but I'm saying it's not doing very well, and it is key to integration of IDPs. The Department of Planning, the Ministry of Planning, has created an entity called Red Juntos. I don't know how to say that actually in English. Together, a network. Anyway, it's a network that supposedly wants to address both displaced persons and impoverished persons, poverty and displacement, under the same umbrella, and to try to do both at the same time, try to improve the lot of the extremely poor and of the displaced persons at the same time. To date, they have established, as Armando Escobar just said, a database. But what it means is that to date, the only thing that we see are people based in Bogota going to the field and interviewing people in the field. So it's going to be a while before Red Juntos actually does anything, I think, anything of a significant, of lasting nature. The second qualifier is related to who is eligible and who is not eligible. This is the big debate about numbers. Now, the number of ineligible IDPs is really much too high. Nearly all of the donors and all of the NGOs have programs that encompass a much broader range of people who are displaced than the government program does. The government criteria is displaced by violence. Privately, when one talks to government officials, they will acknowledge that forced displacement due to fumigation of land, due to land grabs, due to recruitment of youngsters, due to threats of different kinds are all very valid reasons to consider persons having been forcibly displaced. But those persons would not qualify under the government criteria and do not qualify under the government criteria. And therefore, that leaves open the question, and I mean it's open. There is a decline. Martin Bisick has said, in the number of displacements, but there is also a decline in numbers due to the narrow criteria for judging displacement. So, and I don't pretend to have the answer to where the how those numbers line up. Third qualifier, and this is something that I was very, very pleased to hear Armando address. The Acción Social and the government apparatus in general for the attention of IDPs is overly centralized. It's centralized in Bogotá. Ultimately, as everybody acknowledges, local officials have to be enlisted and engaged, and they have to be resourced for programs for attention to IDPs. And yes, of course, I acknowledge that there are places, there are local officials through whom one would not want to channel any resources at all. But still, there are many through whom it is necessary to, with whom it's necessary to work, and even to take some risks. All of the mechanisms are top down. And, you know, when I first went to Colombia, I was totally misled because I kept seeing and hearing about entities at the local level, at the departmental level, at the national level. There were commissions and consejos and committees and mesas and all of these consultative mechanisms through which supposedly everybody involved in IDP attention would be involved and could be involved in making policies or at least advising policies. But upon looking more closely, it was a little deceiving because the existence of these entities gives space for people to voice their concerns, but I think fall far, far short of serious consultations. You find that the various entities don't talk to each other, and the communication is overwhelmingly top to bottom and hardly ever bottom to top. And so the best you can say is all of these entities of consultation, which I think could be cut not only in half, but by a quarter, perhaps, and made more effective, they don't really have much of a voice in the policy-making arena, except as advisors. Well, exceedingly distressing, I mean, perhaps I won't say the most distressing, but exceedingly distressing is a lack of protection to IDPs, and especially to indigenous and Afro-Colombian IDPs. The measures in place... there are measures in places of origin to try to avert displacement, and maybe they've worked. That's something there. What comes to mind are the measures for early warning, for socioeconomic improvements, for land titling. All these are very important measures. The extent to which these measures have actually convinced people or persuade or allowed people not to be displaced remains to be monitored. I mean, I don't know if anyone was actually going and seeing the extent to which all these measures are effective. One hopes that they are. But people are still, they haven't to date prevented displacement. People continue to move. They continue to move because of all the reasons that we already know. Moreover, and I think this is also important and not taken into account enough, people are displaced multiple times. The first displacement leads to a subsequent displacement for the same reasons, because of violence, because of threats, because of forced recruitment, because of loss of land and property or never having acquired land and property. And so you've got an IDP population that is extremely mobile and extremely unstable. And when the point at which IDPs consider and are encouraged by the government to go back to their places of origin on the argument that these places of origin are now safe, it turns out very often the government will help people go back, then the government helpers disappear, and people are left stranded and they're not protected, and so they end up, for various reasons, having to leave again. So the policy is a waste of resources if that's the end product of it. Now, let me just say in the last minutes I have, let me say a few things. I don't know how many minutes I have, but I'm okay. A few words on national security and IDP security. And I'm not saying national security versus IDP security, because I think IDP security is part of national security. That is really my basic argument. There are five regions called Areas of Coordination and Integrated Action, five corridors in Colombia, which are the war zones, the former conflict zones. In these, and the strategy of the Colombian government is counterinsurgency, eradication of illegal substances run by the military, under military control, to be followed by civilian-led recuperation of those areas for the state. And that means bringing governance, civilian governance, and services to the people who are there. Theoretically, this is a very good process for ending displacement, because logically, if the major threats to security are removed, and the people who would be displaced don't have to be displaced, they can stay where they are, and people who are displaced, theoretically, can go home because the major threats are no longer there. Why doesn't it work? Because it really doesn't work. In the short run, the CCAI, the process augments displacement, increases displacement. First, fumigation. Fumigation to remove illicit crops. The fumigation by air, not physical means is different, but by air, eliminates all the crops in the area. And so even USAID has complained on multiple occasions that they bring in alternative crops for peasants in these areas, and then the fumigating planes come and destroy everything, including their projects. This is not a good message. This is not really a very helpful policy. The policy of the government is zero tolerance for drugs, for illicit drugs. I mean, the U.S. could listen to the U.S. officials have a similar one. Well, the zero tolerance for coca means the following. Farmers who are committed to eradicating coca, not to cultivate coca, who want to be part of the programs for alternative crops and are willing to adopt them, nevertheless are facing a transition period during which they have no income whatsoever. And so what do? They have a little bit of coca. They have a little bit of coca for income until they can make the transition. This means they are totally ineligible for all the benefits, and they're pursued by government policies, and they very often can't stay where they are because their crops are eradicated and they're pursued. Moreover, let me say a few things about return to areas where to these conflict zones, to these semi-conflict zones. The government would like and is encouraging, strongly encouraging, promoting people who are IDPs to go home and lending support to this process, as I just said. But they haven't solved the problems that prevent return, which are land insecurity, number 1, 2, and 3, I would say, and then the other problem, which is the protection problem. Peasants who are in these areas or return to these areas are caught in something of a vise. First of all, the government accuses the peasants of giving material aid to insurgents, which they probably are doing because the insurgents threaten them and say that you have to do this or, you know, you give me what I want or I kill your sister. So they do. The insurgents, by the same token, accuse the peasants of revealing to the government authorities where they are, which they undoubtedly are doing, and therefore they suffer the consequence of having done that. There's no one to protect them from this kind of situation. I was part of an evaluation team looking at USAID's programs in Colombia. And I want to end on a somewhat more positive note. The evaluation team emphasize one simple point. If you want a policy to help the internally displaced person, the attention needs to go to where the IDPs are. And that sounds simple, to the receptor communities. And in these receptor communities where, by and large, IDPs who are there want to stay if they can. And most of them would rather stay than to return, especially if the alternative is to return to a place where there's still conflict and no possibility of livelihoods. Many of these communities that I'm speaking of are in the CCAI zones, but they're in the cities. They're not in the more conflictive rural zones. And the cities tend to have less violence. They're not in such contested areas. They have better organized security forces. They have more economic opportunities. Local officials in several of the places we visited are really committed to trying to do their best for the IDPs and for the rest of their citizens. They're cleaning up their act, to put it in the vernacular, but they have no resources. And they don't have the ability to make their own decisions. They can't plan. And if they could plan, they'd probably do a much better job than anyone in Bogota could possibly do, because they know the terrain. So in conclusions, I just want to say one sentence conclusion. And that is that there is no separation between national security and IDP security. Because if there's no attention to IDP security and well-being and IDP integration, then national security is sacrificed. Therefore, my advice, my humble advice to the Colombian government, is follow along the positive lines that have already been outlined, but also keep in mind that attention to IDPs needs to be focused on IDP needs, on IDPs themselves, and not on the big picture of doing away with insurgency and doing away with COCA instead of the IDPs. Or rather, don't sacrifice the IDP policy to those policies. You can do both, but you have to do both. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. And thanks to all three of our panelists for presenting different perspectives on the complex situation of displacement in Colombia. We have now about a half an hour for questions, and if it's okay with the panelists, I think we'll take two or three at a time and then give you a chance to respond. And we have microphones, if you could also identify yourself. Let's go one, two, three.
My name is Jim Jones, and I've worked sporadically in Colombia over a period of about 40 years. I found the presentations very interesting, and I certainly would agree that with Ms. Weiss, okay, that the democratic security policy has compromised, I think, in a very serious way, efforts to address the needs of the IDPs. The ways are numerous, and I won't go into those. One issue that I have picked up on after talking with a lot of IDPs and also refugees across the border in Ecuador and in Venezuela and in Panama, the Darien of Panama, if there's one thing that characterizes the attitude of these IDPs, it's fear. It's fear, 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 big time, fear writ large. And so with regard to the second of the three categories that Mr. Escobar put on the screen, I guess my question is, what is the government program in place to address this fear? I mean, fear of government that historically has allied with these paramilitaries, fear of insurgents, fear. I mean, it gets in the way of everything you try to do. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take Melanie and then the woman in black.
Thank you. I'm Melanie Teff from Refugees International. Mr. Escobar talked about the need for the fact that there's a differential approach to different groups, for example, women, in the type of assistance that Acción Social gives, and the need for more guidance on more assistance with how that differential approach should be put into effect. But in 2008, the Constitutional Court, in its Order 92, gave some very specific orders about the way in which that differential approach should be put into effect for displaced women, and it listed 13 socioeconomic programs that should be set up. Last year, I was in Colombia talking with women's groups about the way in which that Order 92 had been put into effect, and really almost nothing had been put into effect a year later. We're now nearly 2 years from the court order. And so I wanted to ask what has been done to put into effect Order 92, the 13 socioeconomic programs, the consultation with women's groups in setting up those programs, and the criminal policy on sexual violence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take the third question here and then give you a chance to respond.
Hi. Hi, my name is Leah Spellman, and I'm with International Relief and Development. We're a large NGO funded by aid, and we currently have three programs in Tumaco on the southwest coast. I had a question combined for Mr. Escobar and Ms. Fagan. Ms. Fagan, you spoke of the Ministry of Planning and the fact that they had already done some preliminary field research and spoken with IDPs. It seems that there's a theme of a lot of different groups in government doing research that maybe could be shared. And I was wondering how willing the Ministry of Planning, maybe Mr. Escobar, you can speak to this, had been to share that information with NGOs or different government organizations, and if there were mechanisms in place to facilitate that communication. Thank you.
Thank you. We turn to the panelists now for the three questions of addressing the fear that IDPs have, the Court Order 92 and its implementation, and the question of sharing of research within the, particularly the Ministry of Planning. Would you like to start, Armando?
Okay. I couldn't agree more with Jim that probably fear and, in general, psychological attitude of IDPs is the one thing they should work the most before you try to do anything else. Whatever you do after that, it will build on a better basis if you have addressed that issue. In Acción Social, we created something that's called the PAI, which is the initial program for income generation assistance. And what we do in that program is, out of the 9 months of treatment that we give to or we provide to the IDPs, the first 4 months are basically to build up their confidence that they're able to go back and to be mostly productive again, but in general, citizens again. We have been able to assist close to 200,000 IDPs with this program, which is one of the first bad news because you really need something bigger than that. The results in terms of building confidence on or in the IDPs are great. The results in turning this into income generation capacity is not that great. But we need to do more of that particular program. But we also need, let's say, to institutionalize that program because we did it as an extra program in Acción Social when we don't really have the main responsibility in terms of psychological assistance to the IDPs. But I think we are the coordinators of the systems, and as coordinators of that system, we do agree with you 100% that we have to do more and our, at least, let's say, health system should have a special program of rehabilitation and psychological assistance to IDPs so they can reintegrate in whatever other programs there are in a better way. We started to do that mission. It goes well, but their numbers are still very low. In the budget that we have put together, $22 billion, we expect to have universal coverage of that program. So if things go right, we will have more and more IDPs with access to that program or something like that program. So in general, at least on paper and on numbers of money that is being that is going to be put into that, the news are encouraging. Let's hope that it works because it definitely is definitely. I have to admit that it's hard to for the health authorities to convince them of the importance of something like this. Importance in terms of a very massive and huge effort in order to address the confidence and the fear of the IDPs. But I think they're getting there. They're getting there at least with our hand behind. Saying, here's what we do, this is what we have to do. Most of actually USAID money has gone to programs like this, similar like this.
I want to close with, let's say, a comment which is complicated. We know it is very important to address fear and confidence before you do anything else. But our first, let's say, enemies of that is are the IDPs themselves. Some of the IDPs themselves and some of the leaders themselves. Bringing about confidence and a fight against fear will take several months, if not years. When they get into the programs, they want to see the money first. Where's the money? When do I get my money? I need my money to go and do whatever. Many of them either drop out of the programs or advise their IDPs to drop out of the programs. That happens mostly in big cities. That doesn't happen in small cities or medium-sized cities. That happens mostly in Bogota, a little bit in Medellin, where it's very hard to keep people, because the effort actually to go into the program is bigger. You have to pay for transportation in order to go to the places where the conferences and the support takes on, and they believe it is too much of a hassle to do all that, that they what actually need is to pay their bills today. So where is the money for that? I don't really want to go. But we work with that. But I just wanted to make that comment because it is hard when you try to do that. Second, I'm going to be completely open. I firmly believe that the Constitutional Court made a huge mistake in saying that the differential approach to women is setting those 13 programs. We have addressed this issue permanently with the Constitutional Court, at least in order to make them understand that we probably need the 13 components of those programs, but we don't really need 13 different programs. It may come to 12, to 2, just to one program in order to address that. We have created, in a very firm way, at least two programs that encompasses probably between 6 to 9 components of those 13 so-called programs that were stated in AUTO 92. What are the programs that are, let's say, the most advanced? Families in Action in itself helps families and women in order to take care of their children, which is one or at least two of the preoccupations of those 13 programs. We have started a program called Mujeres Productivas, Productive Women, which addresses at least between 2 or 3 of the other 13, among the 13 concerns of the 13 programs that we have, and is running for some 6,000 women now, but it has to be run for something close to 100,000 women in the future in order to make a difference for women. So one of the difficulties, and I think the general idea of having a very huge and firm affirmative action for women was very good. The way it was ordered to the government, it was a very lousy way. It was not a good idea. So the government in this side is saying, what do I do? Should I just create 13 programs to follow up the mandate when I firmly don't believe that's the way? Or should I try to convince and see and work with the court to make them understand that a different approach would be? We have spoken with almost every part of the society that is interested in the programs or in this issue, and we all agree that the approach is not having 13 different programs. It's just addressing the 13 different issues that are beneath or behind those programs, and that's what we're trying to do. But again, I don't believe that under or the orders are clear-cut suggestions on how do you address the issues of women. It just addresses the problem, but not the solution. What I'm asking here actually as an advice is, who has a solution? For instance, one of the programs says, when the woman has to move from point A from to point B, and that was one of the examples that is in the sentence, or we need better lighter areas because women get the risk of sexual assault. That's easier to say than to handle. We have at least 1 million women in the registration. We would like all the 1 million women, when they mobilize through the country, to have lighted areas. How do you go about doing that? That's a very complicated issue to solve, and it's inside the church in programs. So things like that need like a different or better approach if you really want to change things, because we all do agree about the sexual issues and the sexual threats that women face.
Anybody want to comment on the question about access to research of the Ministry of
I want to say something after.
What do you want? How do you want to do this? We have each one of us.
Sure.
I mean,
if you'd
any
like
questions?
To,
or
sure. If you'd like to comment on any of the questions.
Because you might as well continue with all the questions.
Let me say something about. We are, first, the people who visit the family are not in Bogota. There are 7,000 social workers. One of the requisites of being a social worker for IDPs and for vulnerable people in general is that they are from the region or from the city that you're helping. That actually creates a lot of problems because many regions don't have enough trained people, but we're working on that anyway. And they produce a baseline that is going to be, hopefully, before the year ends, to disposal or to for everybody in our webpage.
Any other comments?
Okay. You're done.
Okay.
So that, because it wasn't clear whether we were going question by question or all three of us. Okay, I can just pick up where Armando left off. Why don't I pick up with the question about the communications and the information and the research, mm-hmm. because that is really a thorny and difficult area. Totally agree with the speaker who said, you know, where is the information? Why can't we access it? Why can't NGOs have it? We found that it was very, very hard to get information on almost anything. Because the information channels are not very well developed. And if I were a donor, I would say, you know, one of the major priorities would be to vastly improve the whole IT system, the whole information system, so that it's possible to get a database that, you know, that not only one entity has, but that other entities can access. This is a technical problem, but it has serious ramifications. And it has serious ramifications in the area of services as well. For example, one of the entities that we're always looking at has the wonderful name in English called the WOWS, you know, which is not spelled W-O-W, it's spelled U-A-O. And it is the entity in each municipality, in every district, is it? Or is it
municipality.
What?
Municipality. 37 places.
Yeah, in the municipality that tells to which presumably an IDP family can go and be told where their health services can be delivered or can receive the health services on or near the premises, and which coordinates all the services to which IDPs are eligible in an intelligent and in a usable way. And the unevenness of this system is legendary. It just, some places it works reasonably well, some places it just doesn't work at all. And so people, and this is part of the fear question too, so people coming to the WOWs don't always find what they need. And people coming to the WOWs end up reinforcing their already pre-established prejudices against governments, because the government entity at that level, at the level of where the rubber hits the road, at the level of where they need it, isn't there. And the health system is in place, but the health system is somehow, the numbers don't come together. The health facilities are in this corner, the people in need are in that corner, and there really needs to be much more communication between and among them. Besides, I mean, I do agree with the sharing as well, and even the sharing with donors. It's hard for even donors to get adequate numbers of who's doing what. So that's definitely a need. Let me say something about the fear that Jim Jones raised, the question. I'm not a Colombian, and perhaps it's not my place to give a history of Colombia, but I think I can say a few things, that most of the IDPs come from rural areas. They come from rural areas where the Colombian government has not been particularly prevalent or even present in past years, and that's part of the challenge of today, recovering these areas within the Colombian state, so they are actually part of the Colombian state, the Colombian homeland. The real powers in these areas in the past were large landowners and, on occasion, the military. And so people who are being displaced have a notion of government which consists of when the military comes, that's who the government is. And they haven't had the positive experiences with civilian government that urban dwellers and the people who are part of the core of Colombia may well have. And so overcoming this fear is indeed a challenge. And you know, I quite agree that this is the major challenge, because they've
they've not been exposed to. They've been exposed to people who want them to do something and are willing to punish them or threaten them in order to get what they want. Now, what the this is where the challenge of local authority, I think, comes in. If the local authorities, I think the local authorities have, those who have tried, have made more progress in approaching IDP organizations and establishing decent relationships with them. But the problem is they can't come through with what they promise. They can't come through with what the IDPs want because they simply don't have the resources, and in many cases they don't have the decision-making power to comply. So it does come together. I totally agree that it's necessary to overcome people's distrust of government. That distrust of government has historical roots, but it's going to take a long time to and a lot of positive action to reverse it.
Okay, thank you. Martin?
I think the assistance should from the beginning be as integral as possible. The fear factor has to be integrated. Well, the psychological, psychosocial aspect has to be taken on board from the beginning. You need food, cash, or whatever from the start. And I think there are efforts to be made to try to do that. We as ICRC, we try to associate to each individual assistance project a psychosocial project. So that if our interviewees can detect such type of problems, the victim can directly be referred to a psychosocial entity, which is usually done by the National Red Cross. The WOW is a very good strategy. It's the first entry point where the IDPs can come to meet the government and to basically have all the entities at once. So one office which has all the services ready. The strategy is very good, and I think it starts to work in several towns. We have, as ICRC, supported several ones in the country. We have selected a number where we support financially and with other efforts that the service can be provided. But it's a long way to go. I think where the municipality, the alcaldía, I mean the mayors, are behind the project, it's going to take off. Where the mayors don't have the funds, are not motivated, or have other priorities, there we have a problem. Or there it's going to take simply much longer time.
Thanks. Let's take another round then of questions. Let's get this gentleman in the back here, and then one here, and maybe one here.
I have two comments. Basically, one on a. The microphone working? Okay. I have two comments. Basically,
could you identify yourself, please?
Vicente Chandia from the Colombian Embassy. One very brief comment on some information that was mentioned here by I believe Mr. Jones about the linkage between the democratic security policy, the national security policy, and displacement, and that being the cause for displacement. Just to give you, some information that I believe is useful, the years in which displacement was bigger in Colombia were the years 2000 from 2000 to 2002. The democratic security policy started in June 2003. So there was no security policy before, so you cannot establish a link of causality between displacement and the national security policy. And another comment on the information on the presentation by Ms. Fagan and the comments she made about the national consolidation strategy. You mentioned that the SECAI wasn't really working in the new strategy, that there was no transition initiatives, no subsistence assistance for the peasants who had to eradicate their coca. And I believe then that you misportrayed a bit the program, because the national consolidation strategy precisely has and it has had very important results in La Macarena, as I'm sure you're aware, and Montes de Maria, where not only is there no aerial spraying, there's only eradication, manual eradication, where there is the transition initiative, precisely the one you mentioned, and precisely the aid that comes to La Macarena in a large amount comes from OTI office in the State Department. So we're actually covering what you said. And the SECAI gave way about 2 or 3 years ago to more local what we call now fusion centers, but I'm sure Armando Escobar can give a more clearer picture about that consolidation strategy, because I believe it is really being successful, and that's the food security that comes with the transition initiatives, so that the peasants, while they eradicate for 6 months or a year, get sustained income from the government, actually, because the cooperation from USAID is given, is funneled directly through the government. So I believe there are some changes from what you said and the consolidation strategy that really make it different from what was portrayed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take the woman over here.
Hello. Jimena Sanchez from the Washington office on Latin America. Sure. Well, first of all, I would like to say that we at WOLA greatly welcome the establishment of a unit to look into the crimes that generate displacement, given that for the past 12 years, the impunity rate has been more than 95% in those cases. And my first question is for Patricia Fagan. The whole point of Law 387 as a framework was the beginnings of what then became the Guiding Principles on Internal Displacement, the notion that you had to have an integrated response of protection and assistance throughout the three phases. However, what we've seen in Colombia, which is always lauded as the model, is that only one aspect or certain aspects, sort of picking and choosing of those guiding principles, has been implemented. So my general question is, at what point will the international community start to think of the fact that there may be needs to be a new model on how you address internal displacement, rather than thinking about a model that's not implemented fully? And then my question for Armando Escobar is, given that the government's policy of democratic security was basically to prevent further displacement, how do you respond to CODIS's claims that under the Uribe administration, more than 2 million people have been newly displaced? We would like to know how you view that. And also, given the increase in resources that the government has given to internal displacement projects in recent years due to the Constitutional Court order in 2004, why hasn't the Constitutional Court lifted the state of unconstitutional affairs? We would like to understand that. And then lastly, we understand that orders 004 and 05 of Afro-Colombians and indigenous people are orders that ask a lot of the government. And that within those orders, there are 64 requirements for prevention of displacement of Afro-Colombian communities and 34 or so for indigenous communities. And while that might be excessive or, you know, a very broad ask, would like to know how many plans, whether or not there are the plans that were recommended by the orders themselves, have actually been put in place to prevent any of those communities from becoming newly displaced since this has been put into practice. Thank you.
Thank you. And then I have the woman here.
Hi, my name is Jessie Snyder. I work at the World Bank. My question was just in regards to Ms. Fagan, what you had mentioned about the integration process. Given that displacement's not exactly a new issue in Colombia, I was just wondering if you could comment on maybe why in maybe Acción Social, this issue of integration and income generations become a focus so recently, and if the government's doing anything to work with integration more heavily as well, especially given they have such a large program to provide aid, continuous emergency aid to refugees, and maybe just comment on what kind of successes you have had moving people beyond the displaced status. So
That's
to both. Yeah.
I don't have much. Okay, and why don't we have just one more short question here.
Hello, my name is Mauricio Leyva. I also work at the World Bank. And I was just kind of curious, like, what is the process of receiving help from the government or from NGOs? Let's say I get a phone call and I'm told that to get out of the house or my family dies by the end of the week. So I decide to leave, and how do I prove that I received the phone call, that I received the threat? And how do I prove that I own a home and I own the land?
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll give you all a chance to respond and ask you to please be brief. All these questions.
Yeah, right.
You understand, Armando? Good. Couple of things, just to comment on what Vicente said at the beginning, and which actually was a response to what Liz said in her presentation. Two or three things. One is
It is not true. We do not register people for recruitment or for airspace or for fumigation or whatever, the eradication process. We have several people who have been registered for that reason. Mostly, eradication has many phases, and some of those phases we don't consider them displacement. But many of them are considered, and there are many people, probably by the thousands, who have been included as displaced in the registry because of those reasons. Actually, in 2001 and 2002, the main reasons for inclusion in our registration was recruitment or the threat of recruitment. It was the big reason back then. Today, the big reason is threat, you know, threat of death. But back then was recruitment the number one. CCAI was designed for 68 different points, particular points in Colombia. It wasn't even municipality. It was less than municipality. It was veredas who were badly threatened by violence or badly affected by violence. I believe in most of those 68 places, CCAA made a huge difference for those regions. It made a difference, of course, the biggest one for the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta. It made a fair amount of difference for La Macarena. It made a fair amount of difference for Montes de Maria. It didn't make a huge difference for Putumayo. It didn't make a huge difference for Catatumbo. It didn't make a huge difference for Arauca. It made a huge difference for the old distension or pacification zone in Caquetá. And it was a good strategy. And I think something like that, like today, National Consolidation Plan, it is a good idea if it steps on the good practices of the CCAI and if it learns from the mistakes of the CCAI. So I definitely think that's the way to go. And I'm going to take for your question on that later on to actually complete some of the question. I don't believe college is serious with their numbers. They used to be. They're just trying to convince everybody that we still have a lot of IDPs out there moving in the numbers that are not really seriously figured out. That doesn't mean that the crisis that we have is not very big still without the very inflated numbers of colleges. So that's one of the reasons we never really try to argument with colleges about the numbers, because still, with our own numbers, the crisis is extremely high. I think three things have evolved during the last 8 years in terms of displacement. Two of them were already there or 8 years ago, but not one of them not as strong as they probably today, and one of them is fairly new. When somebody takes the decision to move today, there are probably three things in mind very strong. Number one, safety situation here is not the best, or it's probably very bad. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't move. That's the reason, and that's actually the basic reason why we all here, because migration is forced and it's not a voluntary decision. Number two, economic situation is not the best either. Things are not going well. For instance, 2008, food prices made a huge impact on rural areas, so that probably was in the mind of many of the people who decided to displace. And number three, today there's something out there helping that wasn't 8 years ago. So taking the decision makes more sense, because I've heard my a close or a far relative actually displaced and registered, and he's getting help. In the last 3 years, we have provided housing to something close to 45,000 households. Those 45,000 households has relatives in the place where they left, have friends in the place where they live, who were probably facing the same kind of stress that they faced when they decided to leave or to flee 4 or 5 or 6 years ago. So that's news are brought back to their homes and say, why don't we leave too? I mean, if they're getting some help, they already got their house, let's do that. An example with a name, La Palma, Cundinamarca. 8 years ago, 400 to 500 families flee. In the last 2 years, another 500 had registered because, I mean, those other 500 were helped. Why don't we do the same thing? Due to the constitutional decisions, many people, many of the money, or much of the money, is going only for IDPs. So that creates a tension and eventually moral hazard for the people who say, let's become IDP too. I also face the same threats that somebody else faced 8 years ago. And since one of the decisions, which was not by the Constitutional Court, but by the Consejo de Estado, made it possible to register back all the time you want, so people today saying, I did this place 7, 8, or 10 years ago. Today, more than 50% of the people who claim are displaced are claiming they were displaced at least 2 years before this previous time, and most of the people are from years of 2004 and before. So that's what is going on, and what explains why still we have such a big numbers. Still, if you remove all that, we still have a lot of displacement. That's the reason why. That's probably very important. The way Auto 4 and 5 for Indigenous and Afro-Colombian was put made the implementation of this policy complicated, but I think it's the right way to go. The Ministry of the Interior is holding the consultations that are mandated by those autos. In the terms of the Afro-Colombians, we're using the National Consultancy Group that is there and has always been there in order to provide a little bit more of efficiency to this process. In terms of the indigenous people, I think we have moved with 15 different communities in order to become with a plan for prevention of those communities. I don't believe we will have that work done completely before something of 18 months to 2 years, but it's the mandate of 4 and 5 itself. It demanded that it has to be that way, and that's the reason it takes so much time. One thing you have to do, you can call our 1-800-9 line. You can go to a WOW. But the best place to go when somebody's getting a threat is to go to something or to some place that everybody knows, which is the Personería Municipal. In the Personería Municipal, somebody not only should say, what am I being threat of, but it also would declare the land that is under threat, that is under pressure. And we have a system in which we'll put an annotation on the title of that land so it cannot be disposed during that time. We have made that for 300,000 different titles over the last 6 years. So that's let's say basically a system. I wanted to say something else, but I forgot. Whatever.
Yeah. I'll try to be brief, but most of the questions were addressed to me, so I'll just try to. I apologize.
We are under pressure of time,
for being superficial. I do agree, Armando, with what you said that the CCAIs have made life bearable and better in many, many places, and for all the reasons that you give. But the point I wanted to make, two points, and the one was that by not focusing on those areas where life is already better and making sure that they stay better, but by focusing resources and attention on the areas where there's still conflict and where it's going to be difficult for quite some time, it becomes counterproductive for IDPs. It is not necessarily to their benefit in those zones. The point is, it's a glass half full, glass half empty, if you like, but that is the situation. Transition. The gentleman from the embassy raised the question of USA of transitional assistance to IDPs and to people in the CCAI areas. Yes, there is transitional assistance. It's not a cash donation. The transitional assistance, at least the AID transition and the other donors, mostly it's income generation. It's helping people get settled. It's helping people grow alternative crops, and that is exactly why the fumigation is so negative, because if people are just beginning to get started and their crops are fumigated, and you know the good along with the bad, it really destroys a lot more than even the crops. It destroys people's confidence. So that kind of practice should be very carefully reviewed and returned to these areas. I totally agree that if people can go back, they should go back, but there have to be conditions, and those conditions have to include a stronger element of security than is now the case, and land security, which is not the case in a number of instances. And transitional assistance won't help if the family doesn't have a title to the land on which they're trying to earn a living. So there's a lot more to be said about that, and I'm superficially answering it. But I think still there are those points. Jimena, on the law 387, I mean, you said that there was a model which of course was for assistance and protection, and it's not being implemented. Well, that sounds like a recipe not for changing the whole model, but for making it work better, which I totally agree. And besides, the international community can't do very much to change the model because the law is Colombian and the implementation is Colombian. The integration, I'm sorry for such a brief answer, it's a longer discussion, I realize. The integration process, you know, it's a very good question. For a long, long, long time, IDPs in general, not just in Colombia, but in general, IDP, humanitarian emergency, because the underlying assumption was IDPs will go home. Eventually, we'll solve the problem and IDPs will go home. It's only as the international community recognizes that IDPs often can't go home, and that after many, many, after decades, they don't want to go home, that the question begins to arise in Colombia, because there's so many, but in other areas as well, that you can't just assume a humanitarian emergency and have a durable relief program. You know, you need something that's going to last a longer time and that's going to allow people to stay where they are. But it took a long time. It has taken a long time. And the Brookings Institution sponsored a series on when does displacement end. And front and center in that discussion was, well, it ends when people no longer have to live, you know, are no longer subject to, what is the phrase, Ben?
No longer suffer the consequences of having been displaced.
Yeah.
Martin, last word.
I found the question interesting. You asked, how can we determine today who is a displaced? I've said before, you can declare displacement even if the event was 10 or 15 years ago. How can you have testimonies? How can you prove that you were displaced? How can you today have an objectivity in that subject? I think that's very difficult for any actor engaged in that, not only for the Ministerio Público, the Internal Ministerio for Action Social, or for example for us. So we have to be aware that within those millions of people who want help, there are many who are not displaced as such. That maybe they're poor, maybe they have other needs, maybe they have different sufferings, but they're not to be characterized as displaced. So then to find out how to prove that to them, that's not going to be easy at all. So you need a very good local knowledge. I think the state has the possibility with the municipios, the personeros in the municipios. We try to have delegates in the field where the conflict is in order to be updated always in the cities where the people come to know what's really actually going on there. We have it a bit easier because in ICC we only assist the 3 months, not the 10 years ago. But there is indeed a gray zone which one has to decide to accept the person or not. That's in humanitarian relief business always the case, and that's in Colombia particularly difficult. The figures of CODES do not take into account that there is a certain percentage of gray zone. CODES accepts almost 100% of people who say they are displaced, whereas Acción Social reduces the number with a certain percentage, which I don't want to discuss. And also in our case, we have refusal rates which are very high. To more than 50% of the people who claim, come to our office and say, we are displaced, please help us, we have to say, sorry, you don't comply with our criteria. So it is a very complicated and tricky business, which is not easy to master, and we have to be very careful with the interpretation of those figures.
Well, I began in my introduction talking about the complexity of displacement in Colombia, and I see that we're ending up with exactly the same issue of some of the gray areas and the complexities of determining who is a displaced person, how long does displacement end, what kind of programs are most effective. But I want to thank all three of our panelists and all of you for your excellent questions. Sorry I didn't get to call all of you.